We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management archaeology and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 202 for November 18th, 2020. I'm Chris Webster. On today's show, the crew tries to dispel some common misconceptions in CRM around budgets and seasonality. The CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now.
Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 202. For November 18th, 2020, I'm Stephen, and I'm filling in for Chris, who couldn't be here, as our host. Joining us today are Heather in California.
Hi, everyone.
And Doug in Scotland.
Hey, everyone.
And he's on time. Today, it's early November, so winter just showed up for us here in Calgary, and I'm sure if it hasn't reached you yet, it's about to. So we thought we'd talk about seasonality and how it applies to CRM as a business. I know in the past we've often had episodes that discuss winterizing your career and stuff like that for field techs and other archaeologists. But in this case, I think we were planning on talking about a little bit more about how that ties in with how basically the CRM companies do business and just kind of the seasonal nature of how the industry works. To kick it off, Heather was kind of interested in talking about just general basics as far as budgeting, because that does kind of apply in some ways. Heather, do you want to take that?
Sure. You know, for me, the kind of the impetus behind talking about this topic was just, you know, watching, I enjoy watching all the channels, the social media accounts that, you know, a lot of technicians and CRM professionals in any role are on. And a lot of times it makes me sad to see some of the conversations that I see that really, you know, divides our practice as professionals and kind of has this concept of, you know, the big man is trying to screw the little guy and that technicians are not respected. And in some ways, that is absolutely the case. I think it's more in a general sense. And I think that we as professionals need to be really careful to understand, you know, where maybe the unfairness lies, and that many times it's not in the managerial staff. We should be looking critically, but not being critical about certain topics without having a full, you know, understanding. I think there's a lot of misconceptions when it comes to billing rates, for instance, and why, you know, a billing rate is different than the hourly rate that the technician in the field receives. And I think that, you know, budgeting is really, it's a really complex, it's difficult. It's something that, you know, you have to have a lot of practice at to do well and to actually make money. And we have to remember that as technicians in the field, that, you know, without a company that is sound, is solvent and doing well, we're not going to have a job. So it is important that budgeting happen. You know, the company has to make money or it's not going to be around for very much longer. So, and then we're not going to have a job. So I think it's important that people understand, and part of my reasoning behind this, you know, a portion of this conversation was to kind of just demystify the billing rate. So, you know, I think the going rate or the going, what we call multiplier, is in this field and really in any service field, because the product that we provide our clients is a service. It's not, we're not selling a desk or a computer. We are selling ourselves and our expertise. And so generally, it's that triple multiplier. So let's say, just to make math easy, somebody's making $25 an hour. A technician, Joe, the technician, is making $35 an hour. He works for ABC CRM company. And this ABC CRM company charges their client or bills Joe out at $75 an hour. And so, you know, a lot of times you hear, it's the big guy is, you know, making money off the backs of the technician, when in actuality, generally the profit margin, a company's lucky if they're getting 10%, which means, you know, round it off to $8 out of that $75 that is billed to the client, the company is actually only making $8. And that's actually considered a healthy, good profit margin. So when you think of it that way, and why is that? Like, what else is kind of divvying and pulling money out of that $75? So you have $75, obviously you have to pay Joe. So Joe's being paid $25. And not only is Joe getting paid $25 an hour, but if he is a full-time employee, he's getting paid significantly more than that, although that's not what he sees in his paycheck. But he gets benefits. He has quite a few other benefits that are probably another 30% of that $25. So, you know, now you have, you know, upwards of, you know, $34, $35 that you are taking off the top of that $75. So now you're cut it almost in half. And then you have, you know, the cost of doing business that you cannot bill to your client. And once you do that, especially you have companies that have brick and mortar buildings, you have liability, you have unemployment insurance, you have quite a few other things that are taking out of that $75. You're lucky if you're getting $8 out of that $75 as a profit margin. So, you know, if you look at it that way, you realize that, you know, it isn't such a grotesque amount of money that the companies are making on your hourly billing rate. So,
sure. We were talking before we started recording the show that I don't really care. Like, that's not my job. I don't do budgets. And from a certain perspective, what I'm getting paid is what I'm getting paid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, if that's the amount that they offered and I agreed to, then that's what I'm getting paid. And right, if I wanted more, it's has nothing to do with the budget, right? Like, you know, it's not like, oh man, you know, the company's making $50 off me an hour and blah, blah, blah. And it's like that's completely irrelevant to what I'm actually getting paid. And if I wanted to get paid, I would ask for more money.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's fair.
In my mind. Like, the other thing is, my other big point is, I do care about budgets more from a time perspective. Like, you know, I run projects, I'm out in the field, I need to know that, like, you know, we're going to have enough money to do the project in a reasonable amount of time and not be shortchanged. Like, you know, here's a 3-day project, but you only have the money to do it for one day.
Right.
And it's like, well, that's not going to work. Right.
Right.
And so for me, the budget is more like, so how long do I have, you know, do we have to be able to do this? Am I going to have to hire, you know, like an excavator with, you know, like mechanical equipment to do some stripping? Am I going to have to spend a lot of time in the office doing coordination with utilities and other interested parties? Am I, you know, like how much time am I going to have to do like historical research or, you know, artifact analysis? Or, you know, like, I think of it in terms of person hours,
right,
more than, you know, dollars.
So I'm curious, Stephen, are you the one who actually writes the proposals and figures out the budget, or are you provided a job and said, this is the amount that you have to do it within?
Generally the latter.
Okay.
But sometimes the former.
Okay.
Sometimes, particularly for excavation, like if I go out there on a survey and I find a site, you know, I've been there. I've seen it. I have an idea of what the site is. I have an idea of what the, you know, I want the research design to be like. And I'm sometimes then consulted as to, so what do you think? How many days do you think this is going to take? How many people, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm.
In cases of like survey, I don't necessarily have that level of input sometimes.
Right.
But I do think, particularly after this year, I had a few projects and I've been thinking about kind of self-assessing what my thoughts were of how long this was going to take versus how long it's actually taking, and mm-hmm. how could I, you know, is there a possibility of front-ending like the recommendations of how long things are going to take. Like, how can we better, you know, have a more accurate picture of what things are going to take?
Yep.
Yeah. So my thought has been more along the lines of like, you know, well, if we look at like soils data and you know, like kind of a strongly data-driven approach, like look at what other work's been done in the area and see if we can't figure out how long that took with how many people, like look at the reports, have an idea and try to wrap that into like a smarter proposal, basically.
Right. For me, I think maybe it's helpful to kind of go through just the thought process of when you're writing a proposal, which does, you know, lead into the idea of seasonality. And, you know, first you have to look at, you have a company, a client that comes to you, and you have different types of proposals. You have proposals that are what I would consider or call a sole source proposal, which means the client is your client. They trust you. They want to work with you. They come to you to say, okay, I need this done. How much is it going to cost? And you generally know that client, you know how much kickback they're going to give you for. They don't come to you and say, I want it to cost this, because they're just like oblivious. They have no idea how much it's supposed to cost. So, but then you also have those competitive bids where you're really trying to win the bid. And sometimes there's certain considerations you need to take where you would call it, maybe it's a competitive bid. You're buying a job, even though they're paying you. You're willing to take a bit of a hit so that it, on your profit margin, so that you can establish a relationship with a client that you really do want to have long term, not just for this project, but long term. And so, you know, that a lot of times your profit margin is going to be smaller. And in my opinion, the way I do business, that profit margin does not come off the backs of the technicians. The technicians get paid what they get paid, period, especially on a practical sense, you're opening yourself up to liability if you do it any other way than that. So, you know, as far as labor laws and such. So, you know, when you're looking at a proposal, you do have to, it's more than just like you're saying, yeah, there's considerations of how many people. And I think that's a really good question. For me, I have formulas that I have in my head as far as a survey. How many acres can one person do in a day? But you can't just look at it. You also have to consider terrain. You have to consider how far away, how remote is that project location? All those things need to be considered. And if you're not everybody's good at writing proposals. And if you're writing a proposal and you're not considering all the different things that are going to cost money, it ends up, you know, very stressful for the person who actually has to enact that budget and keep within the budget. And so, you know, they're just like you said, you know, you have to think, am I going to have to pay an excavator and all those things are things that need to be thought of way ahead of time before you even submit the budget. You have to think about, I anticipate every single thing that's going to cost money so you can incorporate it into the budget so that later on down the road, you are not bound to a contract that you can't fulfill without losing money. So, you know, as far as another thing to consider is that, you know, it's not just people. And I wish, you know, people understood that it's just not, I need five people. We have to think about who are those people? Is it, you know, one crew supervisor and four technicians? Do I need two crew supervisors because I'm going to have two separate areas that I need and then I have technicians under them? Because why? Because the crew supervisor is likely going to have a different billing rate or a different hourly pay than somebody who's a technician. They're going to get paid more. So now if that they're going to get paid more, then I need to consider that it's not just straight across the board, five people at $60 an hour. I have to consider that I might have some at $90 an hour. And that's where people start losing their budget, is when they only apply just this roundabout, I need five people at $60 an hour. And I'm just giving, you know, general terms.
Sure.
And then next thing you know, they don't have five people at $60 an hour. They need somebody at $90 an hour. And now all of a sudden you're eating into your profit and the budget just goes down from there. And, you know, these are things that I just don't think, unless you've had to do it yourself, that you're going to understand all the nuances behind a proposal and why you see managers of a project sweating bullets in the middle of a survey going, crap, I've already gone through my entire budget and we're only 75% done with the acreage that we have to do. And it's, you know, that's where it comes from. It's from not having built that proposal on the front end correctly. And I just think it's helpful for people to have that perspective.
Sure. Yeah. And when you do this, thinking about like the seasonality, because I'm looking outside and I literally just finished a field project on Friday and the weather was nice. And then basically winter storm has blown in over the weekend. So like I totally just got by the skin of my teeth in this one. But, you know, like, do you take into account like seasonal weather? Like if it's cold, people are going to be moving slowly. If it's like a lot of really heavy rains, you know, like the work goes slowly, right? So is that a factor?
Absolutely. It's a factor. It's especially a factor. We have some projects that are fairly remote and are likely going to have rain. So now you have people that, let's say you have an agreement, you have already told your technicians they're not going to get paid unless they're actually working. So let's say we have a rain day, we cannot work. So we have a rain day, we can't work. We're not going to pay you your hourly wage, but we are going to take care of your hotel per diem, which any good company should be doing that. You can't strand somebody out in the middle of nowhere and then not be paying their hotel when you have a rain day. I mean, it's just not right. So those are all things absolutely you have to consider. And then also you have to consider, you know, there are some companies, you know, if at all possible, I do try to give somebody like a half a day at work because it's hard. I mean, they're stuck out there where they could have been working another job. And there are some projects where you do have that ability to even pay them for the full day, as long as it doesn't extend too long. But, you know, a lot of that obviously is affected by whether it's a sole source or a competitive bid and the ability of the person who actually wrote the proposal to really have that foresight. Not everybody does. And that's where you get into situations where you're asking technicians to do, or not me, but some companies are saying, hey, you know, I don't want to be the one that's on the hook for having a lower profit margin, which is small to begin with anyway. So you start encouraging your technicians to do things that are just not fair, you know, and that's where I think technicians need to really decide. If you don't like how a business is treating you, and then you just don't work for them anymore. I mean, they get the message that way.
And hopefully you can find a company that does offer you what you want.
Yeah, I think there's a ton of companies that are very fair out there. You just have to look for them. I mean, just like any job, you know, not always going to get the perfect job. In fact, very few people stumble across an awesome job opportunity in any field and work right off the bat. You know, that's just not practical to think that you're going to get that. So, you know, you learn is called, you know, what the hard knocks of life, right?
Sure.
You learn what to look for next time around.
On that note, I think we'll end this first segment and go to a break and come back and talk maybe a little bit more about budgets, but maybe a little bit about seasonality. Back after the break.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code CRMARC. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on price and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 202. We spent pretty much most of the first segment talking about budgeting and the like and expectations and planning. But for this segment, I think we're going to segue into talk about seasonality because it's that time of the year, and if you're not already hunkering down for the winter, you're probably thinking about it. And I just wanted to start part of where this conversation started when we were just chatting before the recording started. I really appreciate the cyclical nature of the seasons as far as work goes. I enjoy field work. I enjoy office work. I enjoy lab work, but I don't necessarily want to do any of one of those things full time. And so right about the time that I'm starting to, feel really beat up from doing all that field work, winter comes and I end up doing a lot of report writing and artifact analysis and maybe some cataloging. And then, just when you start getting a little stir crazy in the spring, field season kicks back in and you're out in the field again. And it makes for a nice, just kind of a process of keeping it fresh. At least it works that way for me. I know that some places don't necessarily have that. When I worked in Georgia, there were dedicated field teams and lab teams. And, some people would go back and forth, but for the most part, they were pretty dedicated. So this seasonality thing doesn't necessarily apply to everybody in who might be listening to this episode. But I think that it is a consideration for a lot of us. Heather, you're talking about how even California has like a seasonal cycle.
Sure. It does. I'm actually kind of curious. And I'll respond to that. And then I do have a question for you. So yeah, obviously we don't have snow. Well, we do in some areas, but generally in the areas that I work in, we don't have that aspect of snow where, you have a very hard ground and you really can't excavate. But we do get a lot of rain here. And I've had projects where it does not matter what's happening. You're working through whatever comes your way weather-wise, unless for some reason it's unsafe. Like you have extreme heat, or if you have a lightning storm or something like that, which actually doesn't happen all that often in California, but those types of things where it wouldn't be safe, then of course that would curtail work. But generally, I think it depends on the project, how much, and the crew, the person who's managing the project, how much weather affects. And for me, it's not as much of a season where, okay, now I'm doing field work and now I'm doing lab work. That leads to my question for you. For us in CRM, or at least my experience in CRM in this area, is that, we have to turn around. We do our field work. We have to turn it around. Our clients don't wait for us to wait until the lab work later on. They need a complete report in order to move forward with their project. And so we don't have the luxury of doing that field work and then maybe hopping to another project and doing that field work and then having maybe an actual season, quote unquote, season of lab work. And so is the nature of what you do allow you to do that? Or that's just what you focus on and you have other people that are writing reports, you just happen to, during certain times of the year, do more report writing than you would in other times of year?
No, that's a great question. No, like particularly for survey and stuff like that, like the short, run out few days doing field work, we usually turn out a report pretty quickly after that. So I guess I was kind of overgeneralizing. Mm. In the summer, we do you go out into the field, work on a project, go back, write it up, submit the report, go back out in the field for a different project, come back, write the report. And, depending on the schedules and the workload that needs to get done, you could be, going from like one field project to another field project to another field project, and then coming back and writing all those up at once.
Got it.
That sort of thing. But there is a certain amount, particularly for mitigation and excavation, because those require that much more lab time.
Sure.
A lot of times those get put off into the winter, unless there's something in the client's timeline that, doesn't allow for.
Yeah, that's interesting, because at least, see, in California now, I'm seeing it more and more where agencies that, the ones that actually are the ones that are employing the mitigation measures or making sure that the mitigation measures are followed, or the ones that are actually writing the mitigation measures, are now including caveats that clients are not allowed to have an occupancy permit or any kind of permit that allows them to move forward with the project until the mitigation measures are complete, the report is turned in, and if it's an excavation and data recovery, that everything is curated according to the conditions of the project. And so, you know, I've seen an increase in the last few years. And the reason is because, you know, like we all know, people do the field work, they will do maybe the analysis, but they are really poor about writing it up. And so, you know, agencies and I think tribal members were really, you know, starting to see how people are not following through and doing what they're supposed to be doing as far as the actual report, which is the purpose of doing the data recovery, that we actually have data in the end that is now there for others to look at and for us to learn about the prehistory of the area. And so I think they've started getting wise to that, and now they write that in the mitigation measures. So now that even makes it more difficult, which, you know, has definitely changed how we look at a project schedule. So I think you're right. I mean, or I shouldn't say, I think you're right. You're doing what you're doing. But in this area, it used to be that you would excavate and then you would do, you know, you sand the lab work out and then you would write the report when you had an opportunity. It was a luxury to be able to sit down and really take your time writing a report. And now you don't have a choice. Like you have to get it done in a certain period of time because, right, you know, you have your client tapping their fingers on the desk waiting for it, because until they have it, they can't move forward. And because we're kind of the last thing that's done, you know, it has to happen quick. So,
yeah. Well, and being the last thing to get done, I always joke that we're nothing more than like really slow utility locators.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to sweep the area, tell you if it's okay. Oh, you want to dig there anyway. Well, we're going to have to move it. So now we have to get all the agreements in place. And yeah, it doesn't quite work that way. First, because Alberta, you know, we get archaeology permits to do field work.
Right.
And in the permit, it's stipulated that you have to do a report and you have a timeline to do it. And it's pretty standard for all the projects, all the permits. And so like not doing a report isn't a possibility. If you don't do a report, you're never getting another project.
Yeah. I wish it was that way.
Which makes your employability really poor.
It really should. We should adopt something like that. I mean, we have something like that for ARPA permits, you know, when you're working on, you know, state parks, land, national parks, land, you have to do some, you have to have a permit before you do the BLM, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. But in general, we don't have that. I think that's an excellent way to go.
So to go back earlier and you know, what you were talking about, they don't get to start the project until they have approval from the Historical Resources Management Branch, which is the government, the Alberta government agency. So just because, you know, we've finished the field work, if we haven't done a report yet, they don't get their approval. So the cases where I'm talking about like, okay, now we can do our lab work. Those are cases where the projected start date for those projects aren't until, in this case, it'd be like, you know, later 2021 or 2022. So by their timeline, we have plenty of time to get it together and get the report submitted.
That's great.
It doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes, you know, sometimes by the time they call us to do the work, they already have the trucks running. And it's like, well, yeah, when did you want clearance by? Because you're not getting it.
Right.
So sometimes we do have people in the lab, you know, in the summer, you know, knocking stuff out because we got to get moving on that report. There is a thing here where they do allow interim reports in certain circumstances, which are very much like for a quicker turnaround. So the artifact analysis isn't quite as deep. It's usually just like mass and counts of the artifacts and you know, with a very kind of superficial analysis of the site and stuff like that. Usually, though, that's, at least in my experience, from what I've seen, that's usually used when you want to do more work. And so you want more requirements. And you don't want to wait until, like, the full analysis is done before, you know, saying, like, okay, now we'd like to do more work. Usually the interim's used to, like, kind of expedite the, like, we really want to do more work. And so we need new requirements from the province, but, you know, time's a factor. So we're going to do it as quickly as possible, you know, within that framework.
I'm curious for people in Canada, and, you know, probably it's the same in the US as well, as far as people that are as needed technicians. Do people just go and find another job? You know, in California, you can keep pretty busy as and as needed and just, you know, kind of hop around from with a few companies and stay fairly busy. So, you know, in an area where you really don't have a choice, you can't excavate or you can't do surveys because of the snow or frozen ground. Do people generally just go find another? Some people say they go south. But then you have to establish that you really know, you have a regional expertise, you have a regional knowledge, and you know, it's difficult to do that, to work in the north and then go and, as they say, fly south. I think some people are successful in that, but that's certainly not going to be for somebody that's coming out of college that is looking for a job, or even for people that, you know, just the average person doesn't have the luxury of just, you know, packing up and leaving for a few months. And obviously, that is part the nature of our business, you know, but, you know, in California, really do appreciate technicians that have a lot of experience in the area. So, you know, I'm not as open to just having somebody who comes in that's never worked in the area before, and you have to start somewhere. So, you know, generally in Canada, what do you folks do when the season of digging is done? What is your percentage of people that would continue to have work, let's say in the lab?
Well, first, like that, you know, time I worked in Georgia that I was talking about earlier, that's exactly what it was. It was a snowbird job. I got hired, drove through a blizzard on January 1st, moved to Georgia and did a project until the spring, and then left that project and went back up north to the Midwest. So as far as the requirements go, yeah, theoretically you need a certain level of expertise, but at the field tech level, which I was at the time, because this was back in the 20th century, I just needed to be able to know what a flake looked like, right? Like,
right.
I don't have to know the full chronology so much as, like, would I recognize an artifact if I saw one?
Right.
And you know, they just wanted warm bodies.
Yeah.
So I got in on that. Here, I don't see a lot of people moving around. And I always find this really interesting. I feel like part of it is because, like, it's not a national system, CRM. In Canada, it's very provincial. Like, I think there is, like, a federal law, but I think it basically says that each province shall have a provincial law.
Got it.
Sort of thing, right? Like,
right.
And so, like, the methods of what happens and what you're qualified to do greatly varies between the provinces. Saskatchewan and Alberta are pretty similar. And I have done some work in Saskatchewan and Ontario as field assistants. I haven't actually run any project. Nope, Saskatchewan I did. I did run one project there. But I don't see people snowbirding. I mean, one, it's Canada. There's not a lot of places for them to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like
BC, maybe.
Yeah. There is some winter work that happens. Like, sometimes you do get called out for a very miserable winter job, you know, because it has to happen. It has to happen now. And those are, you know, the heated tent and the heating pads that thaw the ground and crap like that. And they are very expensive for the client.
Yeah, right. I can imagine.
And, you know, like, I've never heard a whole lot of happiness for people who have worked on those projects. I've never actually done one myself because I've only been working in Canada for 6 years now. So a lot of the winter work that tends to get done is lab work, finishing up like final artifact analysis and stuff like that for technicians. And yeah, we don't keep them all on. And so I think that a lot of them end up pulling employment insurance, basically unemployment for the winter. And you know, maybe they've got like a winter side gig job that they do, or I don't know. I think it varies, and the goal is to get a full time job.
Right.
But, you know, that's the goal everywhere, right? Like you know, have a permanent job, and you know, some people, if they don't get one, you know, eventually they just drop out because, you know, it's a really hard lifestyle to to live in the long term.
In the Mountain West, you end up with a lot of, at least at the field tech level, people going into sort of winter activity, seasonal winter stuff. So all the ski slopes / snowboard slopes open up. And so you end up with a lot of people who, as archaeology ends, they then move into the other seasonal job that they have. And some people can make that work quite well, where they just alternate. You know, there's a couple of winter-based jobs, seasonal jobs, that happen to work really well with archaeology, because, you know, as soon as the snow disappears, archaeology can pick up again. And as soon as the snow gets there, the winter jobs pick up. So, yeah, I mean, there's other stuff, skiing, you know, snowboarding, bits of other sort of wintry stuff, ice skating, all that sort of stuff. So I've known quite a few people that have been fairly successful doing that.
Definitely, it takes a certain personality to be okay with that. That's why I think archaeologists are peculiar personality-wise as a whole, just like any, you know, if you think of a seasonal type of job, or just like you're saying, even, you know, I've had a lot of friends that are, that do a lot of that, you know, they're ski bums or ski instructors, or, you know, working in ski resorts, and they definitely are very similar personality-wise. You have to be willing to kind of go with that flow and not have that certainty in front of you.
Yeah. Well, on that note, let's go to a break and we'll come back and have further discussion about seasonality. Back in a moment.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Welcome back to CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 202. We've been talking about both budgets and seasonality, so I kind of want to like twist those threads together a little bit. Recently, on a field project, I was driving to the project site with one of my bosses, and we were discussing this whole seasonality thing and about how, you know, in some places where it's warm, you don't necessarily have like that level of seasonal downtime. And so, you know, just work just keeps going, right? Like you work through the winter, you work, you know, the lab staff's always on. You basically have permanent lab staff, or permanent as long as there are projects, and it just keeps going. And that brought up a really interesting thought between us, which was, do Southern CRM firms make more money? Like, is it a more viable business model to do CRM in warmer climates, because you don't have to stop? You just keep going. So I thought I'd bring this up because it addresses both, you know, basically both of what we've already been talking about. Anybody want to try to feel this? I think it's probably highly speculative.
Yeah, off the top of my head, I would say it doesn't pass the gut check, just because, so if we're talking just USA here, all the CRM firms are quite small. Mm-hmm. And one could make the argument that the bigger ones are in the South, but mainly it's the Southwest. So unless you're like part of an organization that's been bought out by a bigger environmental consultancy firm, engineering, you know, something like that, some sort of organization that can like then have jobs all across the country and, you know, basically have a bit of a scale factor to them. For the most part, you would expect by now, because, you know, CRM has effectively been going for almost 50 years, you know, 1970s, essentially. So if it was a huge advantage, we would have seen by now that actually we'd have, you know, 1,000 strong archaeology firms, and we would have, you know, maybe just a couple, and they would dominate everything. Or you would have got people who could then buy out firms from the South upwards. So buying out people in, you know, I don't know, maybe you're based in Texas and you buy out everyone heading up from Oklahoma and all the way up to the Dakotas and whatnot.
Well, don't we see that? I mean, when I think about large CRM firms, and
are there large CRM firms? Pure CRM firm.
Isn't Swica?
No, that's an environmental firm. They do more than, way more than.
Didn't they start as a CRM firm though?
I do not know. But I know that they do more than CRM.
Because I thought they had.
Yeah, maybe.
Who's this? I missed the...
SWCA.
Yeah, they're environmental. The largest, what used, well, I don't know if they still are. It was SRI was the largest CRM, primarily CRM, starting out as a CRM company. And they had maybe 100 people, give or take, on anything. So, I mean, I just...
But I feel like these are, you know, like when you talk about like the larger firms, and granted, for CRM, you know, that means like more than 15 people, right? But like when you talk about the larger firms, I think of companies coming out of California and the Southwest, and yeah, they're still small firms there. But
yeah, but that has more to do with where the work is. Just, I mean, you know, everything west of the Mississippi has massive amounts of government land, which results in a lot bigger projects, a lot more archaeology. And that's not to, you know, there's still lots that happens on the east and, you know, northeast and stuff like that. But, you know, you see it with wages. Wages are better out west because there's more work. Mm-hmm. I think what you're seeing with that is basically, that's why I was saying, like, you know, southwest or west or stuff like that. Yeah, there's the South, but like you're not seeing companies coming out of, say, Alabama or Florida or Georgia or someplace like that, that you can mostly do CRM all year round, sort of coming out and dominating. They're not that big of firms. Again, if we're talking pure CRM only, not, you know, environmental firms, mm-hmm. or people that have been bought by environmental firms or, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, the ones from the Southeast that come to mind, like PCI, Pan American Consulting. I don't know. Maybe are they still a thing? I haven't really kept track.
Yeah, I just looked up SWCA, which, from my understanding, is people that work for SWCA hate it when they are called SWCA. I learned that the hard way. But I just looked it up, and it was started by Dr. Stephen Carruthers, and he started, it was a small ecological research firm, but he was an aquatic and terrestrial biologist, so not an archaeologist. So yeah, I mean, the smaller firms have, you know, at least in the area that I'm in, you know, we have some really, you know, smaller firms that focus primarily on, you know, government work or work that requires DBE, that requires a certain percentage of, you know, disadvantaged businesses be on the payroll for certain projects. And so, you know, a lot of times those smaller projects or those smaller companies get relegated to projects that larger companies would be completely, you know, kind of nixed out of because they're not a DBE. Unless the larger company has them on, you know, as a subconsultant. And so, you know, you do, I think you've gotten, at least in this area, you've gotten, you know, certain, except for the small, you know, the meat and potato local projects, phase ones and smaller phase ones for development, that kind of thing. But generally, the smaller CRM firms are doing either as a subconsultant for a larger firm, or they're, you know, doing work that they have a, you know, a better chance of winning because of the DBE requirement. And, or, you know, you have smaller companies that are just, you know, very boutique, very focused on doing very high quality work. And not that everybody shouldn't be aimed at doing that. They should, but there are some that have really, you know, I can think of a few in this, in the California area, one being Far Western, that, you know, they're known for, you know, excellent, excellent work. And because of that, they've carved out a niche for themselves of doing, you know, very good research. And so they get work just based on that. But I don't think that just because of the type of work that we do, you're not going to find really large, I guess what you would conglomerate, you know, type of companies that are solely archaeology, solely cultural. Those larger firms are always going to be a group of consultants and that have a good combination of, you know, knowledge of regulatory knowledge along with the pure archaeology that is necessary.
I also don't see how you could have a mechanism for what we're describing, you know, being able to work, you know, keep your staff on year round as actually creating a commercial advantage, which is a shame. But I mean, if you think about it, like field techs, and you know, we're not like our projects are not judged on quality. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to get a bare minimum. It has to like look good enough to pass, you know, muster with your SHPO or, you know, whatever regulatory, you know, whatever department who's the, you know, primary people on it. So, you know, maybe it's BLM, Forest Service, state something, you know, whatever. You basically just have to produce something that looks good enough. And that's the shame about it, is it's like there's no mechanism, market mechanism for punishing organizations who maybe miss a bit of stuff. So like, let's say you're out on a site and you miss a hearth, which if you had, say, a very skilled field tech, and we should definitely throw it out there that like a skilled field tech is so much better than someone who's just like tossed out there, and they'll find so much more and they'll be able to excavate so much more and be better. But if you miss that hearth, no one's going to know. Mm-hmm. There's no one there to check. We don't have, you know, you don't have any sort of oversight. Occasionally you might have someone pop out to a site from, you know, the overview. So maybe it's a BLM archaeologist who sort of wants to see what's going on, and but they're not there every day. They're not there, you know, double checking and seeing for quality. And so you could just hire in, and I don't say you could, it happens. You basically can just hire in new seasonal people every year. And there's no mechanism with how CRM is set up to give you a disadvantage for doing that. I don't see a mechanism where it'd be great if, you know, for those places to keep their staff on, you know, build up that experience and, you know, keeping a team together, you know, a good team that's worked on projects for months or years at a time will be so much more efficient and so much better. But again, you don't need to, like, you know, if you're doing a pedestrian survey and you miss a site, it happens, but there's not going to be any repercussions for you doing that. And so you could basically just hire in new staff every season, and they may not be the best, but they're good enough. And so I don't see there being any commercial advantage for having, I mean, there's a person advantage, and there's a, you know, being a good human being and keeping someone on for year after year without having them to have the stress of trying to find the next job. I mean, that's a great thing, but that's not going to give you a commercial advantage how we have the system set up now.
I actually think, I mean, from the perspective of somebody who does hiring and in an area that does have work all the time. So, you know, maybe that needs to be at least, you know, acknowledged. But, you know, I have found over time that having a regular set of people that you have trained a very particular way and that you know what you're getting is a lot more pound wise rather than penny foolish. I guess I'd try to switch that phrase around, but you know, hiring new people all the time is for every project is penny wise, pound foolish, because you never know what you're going to get unless you get lucky that, you know, people that you know are available every time you call them, which if they're good at what they're doing, they're probably not going to be regularly. So, you know, I actually think that we have gone as a company have gone to more having a larger full-time staff so that, and obviously it's easier to float that when you're a larger company. We're not huge, we're 600, but that's all consultants, not just, you know, archaeology, and that's 600 full-time. You know, it's so much better. You're going to get so much. There are, you know, good technicians that, you know, we can get for three people, for three new people, one person can do the work of three because they're more efficient and they know what they're doing and they're just more efficient all around. And so, you know, I actually think that having full-time staff that you can count on, it's a lazy way to do business to just start over all the time. And as a manager, I don't like having to scramble all the time for a crew. You know, I like being able to have people at my disposal. And also, you know, if you can't find people, there goes your budget, because now you're reaching, you know, if I have a crew of people for the company that across the board, I have, you know, certain people in all different regions, then I have people I can count on rather than having to pay all these expenses. You know, when you can't find people, you start getting desperate and you start pulling in from places that now are requiring you to have expenses that you had not budgeted for. So I think a company is much smarter to have at least a good core group of full-time employees they can rely on.
Sure.
Well, I definitely agree with that.
I think the reasoning for my initial question, though, is that if, you know, we don't maintain the staff over the winter that we do in the summer, if we can maintain summer levels of employment, because the business, as I understand it, again, I don't do a budget, right? So as I understand it, you bill by the hour by, you know, by person hours, right? Like, you know, we have so many billable hours at this level. We have so many at, you know, like supervisory level. We have so many at like the GIS tech level, you know, whatever the categories are as part of the budget. And so if you maintain greater billing, that's what brings in more money as far as profitability goes. So at least in my head, that's how this process works. So the idea is, if we could maintain basically summer levels of work, wouldn't it be more financially beneficial to the CRM firm than if you couldn't?
Not necessarily. So like what Heather's been describing is really good risk management. So in the sense that, you know, having as everything that Heather's brought up, you know, having the staff there, not having to worry about bringing in people, the costs associated with that, all sorts of things like that. Also, when you have a dependable staff, you know that like the chances of a project going sideways is reduced. There's less surprise, or if there is surprise, you have a staff that is experienced enough that can handle any surprise and won't sink your company because, you know, you've already blown through your budget and you still have 50% of the project to go. That will do that, but...
Okay, but this isn't addressing my question.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
But, like, there is no barrier to entry in most places. And so, yeah, let's say a company does screw up and, you know, because they didn't have good staff and they go bankrupt. Well, there's going to be like six other companies that are going to suddenly pop out of nowhere and be there to take that work. And just because you can also, this sort of goes back, is like, there's only a finite amount of work for CRM. So even being able to work all year round doesn't mean there's going to be work for you. So, you know, like we're talking about, like there are places that you can work during the winter. Doesn't mean that there is always work there during the winter. I mean, construction goes on a sort of cyclical nature, and it could be by regions or, you know, big project comes through, that's great. And then there's nothing for like 2 or 3 years. I mean, not nothing, but you're not able to maintain those levels of staff that you would hope for during that time. And so, yeah, it's nice to be able to keep your staff around all the time, but doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be work for them. And it also means that if you're keeping all your staff around, everyone else, I mean, if we're talking about weather being the main factor here, everyone else that you're competing against can also keep their staff around the whole time. And that means everyone's basically trying to keep staff around, you know, 365 days a year on a finite resource. And that's tough. I see lots of advantages to being able to keep around staff, but one of those being that you're going to make more money and be able to, you know, dominate the CRM sector is not one of them.
Okay. That's about all the time we have, so we'll just end on that note.
Goodbye.
Aren't you supposed to wait, Doug?
You know, I mix it up sometimes. Sometimes
Doug doesn't wait for anybody but Chris.
I feel special that you did that. Doug.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, sometimes I do a countdown. You feel safe with us?
I do. You guys are... I feel safe enough to go early.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question in a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website, or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye. Hear me, Doug. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Doug.
Oh, no, I already said it, guys.
you can say it more than
like
one.
2 minutes ago.
Yeah, well, you can say it again.
You were saying goodbye to our audience. Can you say goodbye to us?
Hey, guys, this is like, there's only one bye.
Yeah.
It's either like really late, really early.
Yeah. Doesn't care about us. Only the audience matters.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Yeah, he's either just going to have to edit this out or edit it in or cut it moving around or just get in our whole like 2 minutes of us just talking.
This will just be the whole third segment. There you go.
Fourth segment.
They get a bonus goodbye segment.
The encore, the encore that no one asked for.
There you go. Anyway, bye all.
Bye.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.